pray together, O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Saints and Sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Special day when Pope Francis is canonizing Mother Teresa of Calcutta. This is from an article. When Pope Francis canonizes Mother Teresa of Calcutta on Sunday, he'll be honoring a nun who's won admirers around the world and a Nobel Peace Prize for her joy-filled dedication to the poorest of the poor. Vatican spokesman Greg Burke told the Associated Press all 100,000 tickets had been distributed for Sunday's Mass, but that the crowd would be bigger around St. Peter's Square. 15 official delegations have confirmed to be in attendance, 13 of them led by heads of state or government, and 600 journalists have been accredited. For nearly 50 years, Mother Teresa endured what the Church calls a dark night of the soul, a period of spiritual doubt, despair, and loneliness that many of the great mystics experienced, her namesake, St. Teresa of Lisieux included. In Mother Teresa's case, the dark night lasted most of her adult life, an almost unheard-of trial. The Holy Mass and canonization by Pope Francis is set for 4:30 a.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, September 4th, per the site. Small of stature, rock-like in faith, Mother Teresa of Calcutta was entrusted with the mission of proclaiming God's thirsting love for humanity, especially for the poorest of the poor. God still loves the world, and He sends you and me to be His love and His compassion to the poor. She was a soul filled with the light of Christ, on fire with love for Him, and burning with one desire, to quench His thirst for love and for souls. Marcelo Haddad Andrino, the Brazilian man whose miraculous cure from brain infection paved the way for Mother Teresa's canonization, told a Vatican press conference Friday he was just one example of God's ample mercy and love. He said, "The merciful Lord looks at us all without distinction." Andrino, "Perhaps it was me this time, but maybe tomorrow it will be somebody else. The merciful mother looks after everyone. I don't feel special." Pope Francis in December decreed that Andrino's cure was a miracle after Vatican doctors and theologians determined that it was medically inexplicable, instantaneous, lasting, and due to the intercession of Mother Teresa, who died in 1997. It was the final step needed to canonize the nun who cared for the poorest of the poor. According to reports, no one but Mother Teresa's spiritual directors and bishop knew of her spiritual agony until her correspondence came to light during a beatification cause. The letters were then made available to the general public in a 2007 book, Come Be My Light. For the Reverend Brian Kolobczyk, sure I'm not pronouncing it correctly, but there it is, the Canadian priest who published the letters and spearheaded Mother Teresa's saint-making campaign, the revelations were further confirmation of Mother Teresa's heroic saintliness. He said that by canonizing her, Francis is recognizing that Mother Teresa not only shared the material poverty of the poor, but the spiritual poverty of those who feel unloved, unwanted, uncared for. That was her experience in her relationship with Jesus, Kolajak said in an interview. She understood very well when people would share their horror stories, their pain and suffering of being unloved, lonely. She would be able to share that empathy because she herself was experiencing it. Tens of thousands of people are expected for the canonization ceremony Sunday for the tiny, stooped nun who was fast-tracked for sainthood just a year after she died in 1997. St. John Paul II, who was Mother Teresa's greatest supporter, beatified her before a crowd of 300,000 in St. Peter's Square in 2003. Francis has made the canonization the high point of his Jubilee of Mercy, a year-long emphasis on the Church's merciful side. Francis has an obvious interest in highlighting Mother Teresa's mercy-filled service to outcasts on the periphery, given that her life's work exemplifies the priorities of his own pontificate. Mother Teresa died September 5, 1997. About a posting this morning about St. Teresa of Calcutta. Today, Mother Teresa of Calcutta officially becomes St. Teresa of Calcutta. The Catholic Church has a formal process of canonizing an individual as a saint. It incorporates at least two verified miracles after their death when he or she has been prayed for intercession. The real hallmark of a saint, we feel, is that they have led a life surrendered to God, that a saint knows God. One of the interesting things about Mother Teresa was her inner life with God that was known only to a very few during her life. After receiving a tremendous experience in God that set her out on her mission to serve the poorest of the poor, Mother Teresa did not experience God's presence. Not only did she live alongside the poor in Calcutta, she also lived a life of spiritual impoverishment. In this way, she was meant to serve the poorest of poor through her example of living simply and struggling spiritually while totally surrendered to God. Who could look at her life with an honest view and not find absolute surrender to her Lord in what she accomplished? I have read the critics of her, but found no real basis for doubting her sincerity and holiness. Even as she lived, Mother Teresa was a saint. Anyone who takes on a greater mission in life will have critics and oppositional forces to deal with. That will be a certainty. And it is not that we should simply easily accept someone's sincerity and lack of hypocrisy. However, we should not lack faith that there are those, even in the international spotlight, who can rise up to sainthood. St. Teresa of Calcutta stands as a worldwide symbol today of service to God in the poor, and service and surrender to God's will. Mother Hamilton, in a Christmas talk in 1980, spoke of St. Teresa after meeting her in Calcutta, and this is what she said. "The real meaning of Christmas is giving. We give to the poor, to give to the needy, to serve Christ in every man, even as Mother Teresa does in Calcutta, India. She is a world-famous Christian saint, and certainly she shouldn't have to wait until after she has died to be canonized, because she is a saint now. I have but to close my eyes, and I see this woman's face before me, not beautiful in a human sense, in an ordinary physical sense at all. Her face is lined with wrinkles, her features are not too good. But she has a light blazing in her eyes, and a light on her skin such as I have never seen before. It is beautiful. And she takes the lepers, she goes out and she picks up the sick and the dying off the streets, and she takes them home to her hospital. And she washes them with her own hands and makes them clean. And she puts clean garments on them. And she teaches these people about the Christ. And each one that comes before her is her Christ in human form. Now, this woman is a great, great Christian. Believe me, she is great. She really serves. She is completely without thought of herself. She thinks only of God through Christ and of serving Him in every waking moment of her life. She gets very, very little sleep. She works ceaselessly. She uses everything that is given to her in order that she may serve her Christ. And her name has spread all over the world. Still, when she was given the Nobel Prize, and they asked her if she had any comments about it, she said that all the honor that had been paid to her was nothing more or less than crucifixion. She had to take time out to come and appear before a world audience to accept the honor which she gave only to Christ, and so she felt that was crucifixion. That is true humility, isn't it? And if each one of us could be humble in that sense, if each one of us, each moment of the day, not just Christmas season, but beginning this moment, would look for people to serve Christ in them, even until you die serving Christ, what more glorious end could you have? That was Mother's quote, and then I continue. And then I will close with a quote from St. Teresa, taken from a book entitled Something Beautiful for God. That's the spirit of our society, the total surrender, loving trust, and cheerfulness. We must be able to radiate the joy of Christ, express it in our actions. If our actions are just useful actions that give no joy to people, our poor people would never be able to rise up to the call which we want them to hear, the call to come closer to God. Isn't that beautiful? You think about this world and how much it's changed with Saint Teresa in it. How we've all known of her and hopefully been inspired by her. She was just one little woman who had an inspiration from God, a direction from God, to go out to serve the poorest of the poor. And she started out very simply. She would just simply go out onto the streets. And she would find people who were there suffering. They had some illness. Maybe they were close to death. And she would take them to a small room. And originally, I think it was a Kali temple that had been converted over into a hospital for her. And she would bring them there. And as Mother said, she would wash their bodies, she would clean them. Sometimes that's all she could do, and they were just in the very last stages, and then they would die. But they would die with clean clothes, clean sheets, and a clean body. And she would give them all the love of God that was in her heart. And so just serving simply like that, without a lot of fanfare, without a lot of people knowing about it, she had to fight a uphill battle to get there. Because the church did not easily grant her permission to go out and do this. She was part of a cloistered community, and they weren't to go out in it in this way. And so she had to get special permission, and it took a while to get there. But finally she did, and then she wanted to start her order. And that also had not been done for hundreds of years in the church, and yet she got that off the ground. And she attracted so many people to come and help serve, not just in India, but all around the world. And how fortunate we all are, that she has been a part of this world, that she brought not just acts of charity in the sense of serving the poor, but exactly as she said, they brought the God element into their service. And it wasn't about converting people. If people, I'm sure, they wanted to talk about faith, she would do so willingly, but it wasn't, we bring you in and we clean you up and now you have to listen to a sermon. Not that at all. They were just simply there to serve and to do what they could to serve the poorest of the poor. And so this has gone out all around the world, and even those who don't follow in her order have taken inspiration from her, and I think we all can as well. As Mother said, Mother Hamilton served all the time. She served differently than Mother Teresa did. She served the spiritual needs of a world that was in trouble. She served the spiritual needs of those who came to her and were drawn to her for spiritual upliftment and transformation. And so her mission in this world was different. So it doesn't have to look like going out and serving the poor as Mother Teresa. There's all forms of service. In fact, if we look at our lives properly, everything that we do should be a service to God. And if we can't find it in ourselves to find a way to make it about serving God in everything that we do, in every person that we meet, then we really need to take a good look at our lives. Maybe we're in the wrong occupation. Or perhaps we just need an attitude adjustment. Whatever God calls us to is our service to Him. And we do it with that joy that St. Teresa talked about. We infuse ourselves with it. We bring ourselves up to it. We attune to God. We meditate first. In the morning, before we do anything else, we center ourselves in God. We feel ourselves filled with that joy. You know, meditation isn't just putting in our time. I remember somebody one time mentioning, well, they must be God realized they've been meditating for so long. Well, that's a nice idea, but that's not how it works. It's not just putting in our time. It's a making actual God contact. Master used to say that he would not stop meditating until he had made that contact. Just think of making that commitment to yourself, that you would not stop until you made God contact. Now, not everybody is able to make that commitment because of other commitments before it, of going to work or family or so on. But if we really take it seriously, and it's not just about performing something, it's about reaching out to God. It's about looking for that bliss, looking for that joy. It's a terrible thing when you think about St. Teresa not having that joy, not having that upliftment. And that was something that God had designed specially for her in her service to this world. It didn't dissuade her one little bit in what she was doing. She still dedicated herself morning to night. And every morning she spent several hours in prayer. And I would like to think that now that she has left this body and this service, that she gets all of that God experience that she did not get during those 50 years. Can you imagine 50 years of going through a dry desert, that dark night of the soul? I just went through 2 years of that, and it was bad enough, I can tell you. 50 years would have been just awful. So that happens to us sometimes, just in our upward path. There are times when we go through a dry time. It just doesn't seem like we're able to make much God contact. And it's not always in our hands. Sometimes it's a karmic thing that has come to us that we have to face, we have to go through. And then there is specifically what is called the dark night of the soul. That happens when you have been experiencing God very greatly and almost continuously, and then suddenly it's taken away from you completely. And it's Jesus described this when he said that you don't pour new wine into an old wineskin. Now the wine is God consciousness. It's the bliss and upliftment of God. And the wineskin is the consciousness, is the mind that has been created. And the old wineskin is your old mind, which is not properly adapted yet to the much expanded, more powerful Christ consciousness that is coming into you. And so that has to be broken. It has to be pulled apart in pieces. It has to be completely emptied out. And then a new wineskin is made. Then a new consciousness begins to form. As I said, I went through 2 years of this, and I felt myself going into it. And gradually, what I had been experiencing before, the upliftment and bliss of God, just started going away from me. And so for 2 years, I went through that. And when I was coming out of it, I had a vision that God gave to me. And I was walking through the desert in this vision, only it wasn't a dry, barren kind of desert. It was desert in springtime. The ground itself was brown, and it was soft and spongy to the touch as I walked on it. The whole desert smelled of a wonderful natural perfume, and everything was just perfect, and it had been so long since I had experienced anything like that at all. And I just let out a cry, and then I turned and I saw where I had come from. And behind me, the ground looked broken, cracked with earthquakes. It was burnt all the way across, and the sky was sooty black. And the feeling that I'd just been holding on to God all the way through that dark night of the soul, He gave me that much grace at least to not let go of Him and to hold on to Him with everything that I had. And He brought me through this dark night. And so from that moment, after I had that vision onwards, I started having more and more God experience. And then Phyllis Victory called me from Vancouver. I had taken sabbatical from being a minister and wasn't giving talks at that time. And Phyllis called me. And she and Marnie had questions about Kriya that they were beginning to deepen in their own lives. And then Phyllis asked me to start coming up to Vancouver and start giving talks, and so I agreed to do that. And so gradually it all started coming back, and that what happened at the very time when I was coming out of this dark night. So it's very interesting how God organized it all. So this is the path that we are on, and if we go through a dry spell like that, or if God takes us through that dark night of the soul, the very essence of what we must do, whether we feel God's presence or not, whether we feel His upliftment, is to remain loyal to Him, remain loyal to our path, and not to let go of Him. This is absolutely critical, because if we let go of Him during that time, then we can be swept away, and it can be lifetimes before we ever get a chance to be able to really firmly put ourselves on the path again. So this is very, very important, that we never lose faith, even when we're not feeling God, even when everything just simply feels difficult and hard. This is a kind of impoverishment of the soul, of the spirit. And it happens for a purpose, for a reason. It helps to empty us out and prepare us for what's coming, for what's going to happen. You know, in Revelations, it talks about all the things that are going to happen in this final world cataclysm. And they're all descriptions of what happens right within your own soul, right within your own consciousness, right within your own body. It all happens right there. So we don't have to wait for Christ to come out of the clouds someplace up in the heavens. That's not what it's about. They've been waiting for 2,000 years and more for that to happen, and it hasn't happened in generation after generation. We see the signs now. We see the signs that it's going to happen, and there's all this preparation, and then it doesn't happen. The people who are of the Judaic faith are caught into a similar fate. They have this Messiah that they are expecting, that they are waiting for, And it's the same story in that sense, in that it's an internal experience. That king who is coming back is not a king of this world. It is a king of the consciousness. And it is placing God on the consciousness. And it is having that savior within that is awakened and begins to really put ourselves on the path. It's when you have that eruption of the kundalini inside of you, that serpent force that before was downward turned towards all the things of this world, all the things of the senses, and now it's turned upward. And it's a powerful force. It's not to be mistaken for something else. I read occasionally about people who say they've had the awakening of a kundalini, and they're not describing those experiences at all. They have some sensations in their spine and so on, but it's not the kundalini. When I had that kundalini erupt, it was a powerful force. Now, it doesn't happen exactly the same for everybody, but it has this tremendous force. You're not just imagining things. You're not just trying to make something happen. It is a force that happens, and you are now at the mercy of that force, so to speak. It's great grace to get that, but it's also tremendously challenging. It's tremendously powerful when it comes. And it takes you on to a journey, the most fantastic journey that we can possibly do as human beings. It is something that changes our lives very fundamentally, right down to the core of our being. It's not just getting an experience here and there. It changes your nervous system. It changes your cellular structure. So the changes are profound and they're deep, and they don't happen overnight. Occasionally we know about great saints, great masters who have a sudden and spontaneous awakening, and they are in that consciousness. Ramana Maharshi was one of these, just a 16-year-old boy, and one day he just felt this tremendous fear of death come over him, and before that he'd just been living an ordinary life. And so he reasoned it out in his own mind, and he thought, well, what is this death? What is that all about? So he laid himself down on the ground. He says, all right, I'm dead. Now what? And in that experience, he had an awakening of that sense of I, the same I that goes into what is God's name. I am that I am. He had that awakening of the I am inside of him. Now, he went through more experiences after that, but from that point on, he was always in that I am state. And so that is what he taught. He taught the path of jnani, the path of reasoning. Ask, who is it who is experiencing this? Who is it who is asking this question? Who is it that is the deepest core part of you? And follow that all the way back to its source, and you will know who you truly are. You are not the body. You are not the mind. You are not these emotions that just change on a moment-to-moment basis. There is something that you are grounded into then, that it is unchangeable, that is formless, beginningless, and endless. And when you know that, then you know who you truly are. And that is the path of the yoni, but it's a very difficult path. And for the most part, in our journey, we are instructed and told about the path of Raja Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. And Raja Yoga are the practices of meditation and going with Kriya and going deeper into meditation and discovering that great I am. The Bhakti Yoga is developing a love relationship with God and becoming focused on Him. What's the most powerful magnetic draw that we can experience? And that is the power of love. And if we have that love for God, if we have that desire for realization, for that union with Him, then that will draw us magnetically toward that great I Am consciousness. And then there is the Karma Yoga, as Mother Teresa had, and Mother Hamilton had it as well. And in that is serving God in people. And everyone that Mother Teresa saw, she saw as her Christ. No matter what their religion, no matter what their sex, no matter what the color of their skin was, it made no difference to her. Everybody she met was that Christ self that she was coming to her in that form. This is exactly the same as Papa teaches about seeing Ram, seeing God in every person that he met. And through that practice, in the beginning, it's a mental practice, and you practice seeing God in that one. And through that practice, you get the real experiences where you actually do see God in that individual. And sometimes it comes in the form of the guru, sometimes it comes in the form of a beloved friend or a spiritual brother or sister. And it is most easy to see God there, but as that vision begins to universalize, you begin to see God in everybody that you meet. And those that misuse and abuse and mistreat you or challenge you or in some other way in the past would have distressed and disturbed you, now that one is just as much God as anyone else. And it's not you just trying to make it happen. It's an actual experience that you have, and you actually see them. This is God coming to you. So this is the most practical, most beautiful way of going to God. So you see, we're given these ways, and many times I have said that this is a fourfold path. We follow all four to some degree, because anybody who inhabits a body, anybody who comes to this earth, they must act. And for the most part, we do something in order to earn our living or to raise our family and so on. And so we are in the field of activity, so we are all karma yogis. We cannot not be. As long as you breathe a breath, as long as you think a thought, you are having action. And that is what karma means, is action, union with God through activity. So at first you practice seeing God in everyone, that you are serving God in whatever you do. And then gradually that too becomes a realized experience. And you are in the flow of God. Everything that you do is directed by God through your intelligence, through the physical activity that you do. There is no separation between you and God. You are a bhakti yoga. You develop that love and devotion for God. There was a time in my life when I didn't feel like I even knew what the word love meant. I felt completely empty and devoid of it. And then God began to take me on to a journey. Mother first started it. And she said, "Why don't you love me completely?" And it just went right like a bomb inside of me and exploded. And I really had to challenge myself. And she said, "Unless you love completely, you cannot have him. You cannot know him." And so it set me on to this. And I finally decided that whatever the cost, whatever the potential pain from loving that completely, that wholly, that whatever, I would do it. I surrendered myself to God. And then he took me to a book about Ramakrishna, a great saint in India who is a great bhakti. A great bhakti. And he took me to another book that was very devotional about St. Francis. And so I was being exposed to these great, great bhaktas. And it began to work inside of me. It's like Jesus described it as the yeast inside of a bread. That you warm that bread and gradually it begins to rise as the yeast gets activated. God sows a seed inside of you. You warm the oven by your intensity of devotion, by your desire to know God, to be one with him. And through that warmth, that yeast gets activated and it starts to lift you up. It starts to change you. It's not always easy and it's not always goes so smoothly. Sometimes it can be very, very painful. Sometimes it can stretch us as far as we think we can be stretched, and then it stretches us a little bit more, and somehow we're able to get through it. Somehow we're able to move through that and go to the next thing. And God does this again and again and again until we are made ready for this highest divine consciousness. If you're not getting the divine consciousness, you're not ready for it. If you were to get everything that God had to give to you, you would literally be destroyed. You would be burnt to a crisp. So you have to be prepared. You have to, your nervous system has to be prepared. The cellular structure in your body has to be prepared and aligned. Your thoughts have to be prepared. You have to prove yourself by what has been given to you. God gives us things, and sometimes we look at them and we think, well, they're not worth much. So we don't really put them to work. We don't do much with them. And he talked about this with the different people who receive different amounts of money. And one man got very little amount of money, and he was afraid to lose what he had, so he went out and he buried it in the ground. And another man got a middle amount of money, and he put it to work somewhat. The man who got the most money put it to work the most. Now, in those days, money was called talent. And you can think of it as your own talents, your own things that you have been given. There are some people who have been given great talents in this life. It may be to do with music, or it may have to do with any form at all that it comes in. But they don't value it. They don't put it to work. They don't lead a selfless life where they really try to help humanity with it. So it is that little bit that has been given to them is taken away. But if you take the talents that God has given and you show courage and you go out and you demonstrate and you activate what has been given to you, you build upon it, then more is given to you. And the more that you give it away, the more that you receive. And this is the principle, this is the law of how it works. Those people who give so much receive so much. Now it seems like, from a material standpoint, sometimes somebody does squirrel away their money, and they do keep it. The miser who keeps all of his money. But you look at his internal life, you look at his internal consciousness, and he lives like somebody in poverty. Somebody who is always afraid that whatever they have will be taken away from, that's a very poor person, no matter how much money that they have, because there's never enough money to make them feel secure. And somebody else who has very little, and they give freely of what they have. Now, it doesn't always mean that the poor person who gives freely will become physically wealthy. But they will feel that wealth. They will feel that prosperity. They will feel the abundance that God gives to them. And they will know that whatever it is that they have has come from God, and that if they feel directed to give it away in this way or that, that it will come to them and come in greater abundance. The greatest wealth that we can have is through our spiritual connection with God. One time, Swami Vishwananda was explaining Lakshmi to me. He had given me a little metal designation of Lakshmi. And he's saying that's not, usually she's seen with coins pouring from her hands. And she's seen as the goddess of wealth. But he says it's not just material wealth. Lakshmi is also in charge of dispensing spiritual wealth. And so it's taken up to a higher level than you see. Now, you can live in a one-room apartment, or you could live in a palace. But if you have God, if you have that bliss, if you have that peace, you will feel whole and complete. And someone else who does not have God can have everything in this world, and yet feel isolated, alone, abandoned, without enough. And it's a terrible kind of poverty to have. It really is. It's the most impoverished we will ever be. So this is the challenge that we have, is to really put ourselves to work, to use Mother Saint Teresa, I should say now. I think the time has come, maybe, when it's been official. And saying, use her as our inspiration. Whether God gives through you in the same way that he did through her, it's the principle. It's that you give yourself. You give yourself heart, soul, mind, strength, everything. You give all that God has inside of you. You give all the love of God. Master used to say, you can be a smile millionaire. You may not have a nickel to your name, but you can smile. And you can give that smile to somebody. You can be a smile millionaire and you can make people happy. You can help lift them up. You see? So it's not just about what you have to give in a monetary sense. When St. Teresa went out onto the streets of Calcutta, she didn't have money to give. She gave of herself. And maybe you just see somebody, maybe they're in a store and they need an extra hand, and you offer it to them. Maybe you meet somebody and they're having a difficult time and you give them some sympathy and an empathetic ear. You give them what you can and how God directs you to give. And when you feel God giving through you, you are the wealthiest person in the world in that moment. There's nothing greater, there's nothing more perfect, nothing more beautiful than to feel God giving through you. Sometimes God gives your compassion, gives His compassion through you. So you feel pain for this world. You feel the suffering of this world. But you feel that it is God who is loving this world through the pain that you're feeling and the compassion that you're feeling. And it sweetens the pain that you have. It makes it tolerable. It gives you comfort even while you're feeling that pain. So you see, there's not one thing in this world that we have to be afraid of when we have God with us. And God is always with you. God is always with you. So let us strive every day to be that kind of giver, to be that kind of lover of God, that everything that we do, everything that we think, everything that we say and do is all an expression of God within. And when that is the case, then how can you be separate from God ever, ever? Yes, it may take some time before we perfect ourselves in this practice and before the grace of God activates itself fully to find full expression in us. But the truth is, you're perfect even in this moment. Part of the conversation that Mother Hamilton had with St. Teresa was around sin. And St. Teresa was saying something about that we have to remember that we're sinners and before God. And Mother said, you know, Mother, the people that I work with, our group in America, I don't have any sinners. Some of them are naughty and some of them are good. But they're all God's children. And you start thinking about that. And you start thinking, what do you focus your mind on? Sometimes these saints, they think of sin because they want to remind themselves not to get above themselves, that they have a human ego and they don't want that ego to get out of control. But really, if you want a total change, a total transformation, if you keep your mind on God always, then that is what you become. You're steering your ship toward the goal by keeping your mind on God. And if you keep your mind on being a sinner, then that's what you're steering your ship towards. So let us drop that idea. It's not that we shouldn't analyze our actions and that we shouldn't make every effort to live the highest life that we know, but that we are all children of God, that we have the divine spark inside of us, that God made us. And as Mother said one time, God don't make no junk. So even if we feel like we're a pile of junk sometimes, we're not. We're really not. Let go of that idea and accept the fact that God dwells in you in this moment, entirely and completely, as greatly as he'll ever dwell inside of you. It's just a matter of whether we have conscious realization of that fact or not. But the fact is, he already dwells in you. He's already perfect in you. He already accepts and loves you. And isn't that a better thing to keep your mind on? Really. So let us celebrate this great saint's canonization with renewed inspiration to go out and to serve God and to serve him with joy. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of
thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence. Are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss. Of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he. Victory to God, victory to God.